Blog Talk Radio.
Turnbuckle Turmoil fans, welcome to the show here on another Sunday afternoon. Sun Guy here with you. It is Referee Day show, and we're going to be talking wrestling referees really quick. Some show notes before we get started. If you're looking for wrestling today, Gouge Pro Wrestling running in Raleigh, North Carolina. You have Kentuckiana Die Hard Wrestling in Jeffersonville, Indiana at the arena, and NWA Blue Collar Wrestling, as usual, at the North Portland Eagles. I'll be there later this afternoon, so get out there, support some local independent wrestling. I'd like to welcome the panel here with us. We have with us from the great state of Florida, Bruce Owens. Bruce, thanks for being on with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We have from the state of West Virginia, Eric Foster. Eric, thank you.
Anytime.
And we have from the Pacific Northwest, NWA Blue Collar Wrestling's own T-Rex. T-Rex, thanks once again for being on with us.
Oh, pleasure.
Well, to get a little bit of background about your involvement as wrestling referees, why don't we start off with a little background as to why you chose wrestling referee as an occupation. We'll start with the senior most referee, and I believe that would be you, Bruce.
If, after 40 years, I guess I have that category. But, no, you know, like anybody else, I was a wrestling fan. And, you know, back then, you know, you're going 40 years back, it was the kayfabe days. And, you know, after a while, you're smart enough to figure some of it out. A guy drops on a guy's head from the top rope, and those days was a disqualification, and, you know, the guy, doesn't get a bump on his head or anything. But, like anything, I think it was just the fact that I was a fan. And when you go that far back, there weren't all the sports teams and sports that we have today as far as TV. There's four or five channels, and so entertainment was limited. And when wrestling was there, I'll give you an example. We worked Miami Beach, was my hometown. You know, they were scalping tickets at 7 o'clock because they had already sold out. And that's the convention center that was holding 5,000 people. So, you know, like anybody else, I also have a background in defense aerospace. My family was in aerospace. So I was able to, a few times I worked in aviation, I was able to pick up some of the guys at the airport because back then the money wasn't as good. So I was off of work, and I had that pass that got me down to the gate. You know, and the guys would be coming off, and after a while I knew them, but, you know, we'll get into a little bit later, you know, how I got in, which was pretty unique, and then, but like anything else, I think it's something if you really love it, and obviously I wasn't, back then I was like 140 pounds, so there was no way to jump in, and my dreams of being a wrestler wasn't there, because, you know, it was either manager or referee, and the managers were getting their ass kicked pretty good back then, and so I decided, you know, refereeing would be in there because every time they got their hand up, so would I. And you get a little more ring time as well. So,
all right. T-Rex, how about you? What led you to make the decision to officiate wrestling?
I think it was when I was a little kid because out here in the Northwest we have Portland Wrestling, and it's really been really big since the 20s. I think getting around that as a kid made me want to do it more. But then as I got more in tune to wanting to venture into the pro wrestling business in general, I started to set up chairs for guys like the name of Sandy Barr and Grappler and guys like that that would hang around the Portland Sports Arena. And so I was a hungry kid, and I decided that if I was going to train, I was going to work early and get started. And I started setting up chairs and everything around like the age of 12 years old, and just started partaking in the show around 6 years old as you know, a fan. But I think my love for pro wrestling came when I started to watch guys like Dutch Savage and them out here in the Northwest. That really was what got me sparked. I'll go into later on how I got into the wrestling business here a little bit later, but that's kind of what sparked me to get into the wrestling business. I've been a fan for years before that and just decided that when I was old enough, that that's what I was going to pursue.
Eric, how about you? What got you into the professional wrestling referee business?
But like everybody else, just a fan of the business growing up. Now, I'm a little younger, so when I watched it, it wasn't as territorial or anything like that. But just a big fan, and really, when I watched it, I always liked the referees. I liked the way they some of them would move in the ring, the way they would react to everything. And like everybody else, when we get into how we got into it later, when the opportunity came, that was just the first thing I chose. I didn't choose to wrestle. I didn't choose to manage. I was just like, let me ref. And it just went on from there. But, yeah, as everybody else, I was a big fan and loved it, and I thought that would be a really, really neat thing to do.
Bruce, you've been involved, as you said, since the days of the territorial system and wrestling was really strong. Being still active today, what are some of the differences, if any, that you notice refereeing in the days of the territory versus the days of the independent system as we see it today?
Yeah, and first of all, you know, a lot of times when people interview certain guys that are, you know, done it 40 years like I do, they're bitter about the changes and, you know, kayfabe's gone and everything like that. But the reality is everybody knows what a Slurpee is, okay? It's a Coca-Cola and it's frozen and it's different. And I was actually around when that got invented. But what I'm trying to say is, if, you know, you wanted Coke, there's Coke, and then there's a Slurpee. When it melts down, it's Coca-Cola. And everything has to change. You know, things move forward and evolve. And what would have worked way back then without all the options of the different sports entertainment, cable TV, and everything that there is today, people wouldn't have continued to follow wrestling. They wouldn't have watched and, you know, saw a guy hold a hold for 10 minutes or something like that. So, you know, some of that, you know, it was good back then, guys like Johnny Valentine and, you know, things like that that were convincing and could believe people. You know, I mean, there's an article in the magazine I've been shot at twice and stuff. People believed it enough in the old days. But, again, their options of what they got for sports entertainment or wrestling, as you would say, was very limited. I mean, it was once a week. It was on TV. The matches that you got to see were only what was, you know, you had to go to the arena to see the real feud with a superstar against a superstar. And I think everything was necessary to change what it is today because it's evolved into a product for what I'm glad for is a lot of the younger people, because it was a locked business when I got in. I got sponsored by guys like the Briscoes, Eddie Graham, who owned the territory, Hiro Matsuda, Duke Kiyomoke and stuff, and these guys are way ahead of your time, but if you follow anything on Google or anything, you can see what it was. The territories, they were kind of like godfathers. I mean, that's back when they would meet and meet in a hotel room, decide, you know, who would get the world title, how long they'd have it, and how it would get dropped, you know. And a guy like Harley Race, based down in St. Louis, had a lot of options on how he would drop it, you know, if he would drop it, even though there was a time they had to drop it, and sometimes somebody wouldn't drop it to somebody. So they made things very intense back in that day. Now the product is what it is today, and what the guys do is so much more fantastic and stuff. I mean, God, if guys back in the day could do the stuff that y'all are doing now, I mean, it would just simply be unbelievable, you know. I mean, fans would go nuts for that type of stuff back then. But I think what you see in general is the evolution of it. and the fact that more people are allowed into it. And the fact that the main thing is that I see that so many more people have the opportunity to live the dream. Because I can tell you for me, man, you know, it was a dream. I grew up poor, and then, you know, I was able to get into a business with no family. And you, somebody mentioned, you know, Lenny Denton and stuff like that. Lenny and I ran together for a while when he was in Florida and everything. Back in those days, you couldn't get in if you weren't family or friend or tremendous talent. And that's why sometimes you saw the big fat guy in the audience and the muscle guy, fat guy in the ring and the muscle guys in the audience, and there's no way they could get in, you know. So I think the main thing is that people have the opportunity now, and the sport's grown tremendously. I mean, I'll give you an example of guys that make the belts and everything. The old days, you know, the belt makers, Reggie Parks and stuff, is making, you know, maybe 20 belts a year total and stuff. Now these guys are making 20 belts a day because there's so many promotions and stuff like that. When I say a day, you know, order-wise and stuff. So the business has expanded, and it's given everybody the opportunity, like some of the younger people said, you know, he put up chairs and everything like that, you know, to get into the business where, you know, many of us would have just been stuck either as a fan and then we would have outgrown it and gone away. But now you're able on the independent level to still work and have fun and break in. And there's so many shows these days, which is good, you know. So everybody gets to work. I think those are the big differences. But the territory days, I mean, they make a phone call if you did something wrong, and you can be blackballed across the country, let alone the territory. You know, and a booker walked in, and for some reason he had heat with somebody from the old days. He'd walk up and say, "You're finished tomorrow." No reason, nothing. You're just finished. So being a referee was kind of a little easier because, you know, if based in Florida, it wasn't like referees were going to try to move territory to territory because that was kind of dangerous. You walk in, they change bookers, and you're out, and, you know, you're in an apartment house or home or something. So you were allowed that opportunity as a referee to be more stable because you were just, you know, there's maybe three or four referees in the territory tops. And that maintains, you know, that way for years. I mean, that's the difference. Today, you know, the other referees that are on here, they know. I mean, you can go to a show and there could be 20 referees and there's only three spots on the card. So, you know, it's a little more competitive. You got to be good in the ring to at least, you know, land those spots. And also, like you said, you got to cooperate, put up the ring, put up the chair. And stuff.
Eric, in the West Virginia area, you have a lot of promotions. You're closer to a lot of the states that are nearby. It's easier to travel than it is, say, out here on the West Coast. Do you find that being a referee in West Virginia, you're maybe going to find it a little bit easier to get work than if you're a referee in some of the more closed-off areas, like, say, a Colorado or a Wyoming, something like that?
Yeah, but kind of like what was just said, you know, you go to a lot of shows and you have 20 referees show up and you only have three or four spots for them. So, yeah, it's easier to find, but there are a lot more promotions running here. I mean, in the area that I'm in, I actually help run a promotion, and there's like two other promotions that run right near us. One of them actually ran the same building as us. And, you know, so that was a little rough, but we kept powering through. But yeah, I mean, referees, someone explained it to me once and it was kind of smart in saying it's like, you know, for workers to go out there, you know, you need 30, 40 workers on a show and to get a tryout. You can sometimes get a spot. But for refs, it's, you know, you can be good, but there's not as many spots, so you have to be extra good. So, you know, it's easier to get onto a show, but it's also harder as well because, you know, if they have those friends or family still in that area and they want a ref, you know, a lot of promotions in this area are still promotions I wouldn't push. Just for the simple fact they don't have good workers. They don't, you know, they have guys that are think they're wrestlers, but they're not. And you know, I've refereed some of those shows, and I talk to these guys afterwards, and I've been in it 18 years and know a little bit here and there, and you know, trying to teach other refs and stuff like that. So it's easier, but it could be hard as well.
T-Rex, you broke in with Sandy Barr, who had worked for Don Owens for many, many years. He was from the territorial days, but by the time you got in, the independents were what had taken over. Do you think that being brought up by someone that was from the territorial system made it easier for you as a referee, or do you think that it took you a little bit of a time to adjust to the change in professional wrestling that was happening back at that point?
I think the opportunity was there to succeed right away, but for me it was more of an adjustment because I'm not your quote-unquote typical ref. People can look at me and tell that I'm a lot different than probably the rest of your guests on this panel. But for me it was just a simple, you know, adjustments. I got to, you know, get in Sandy's ear quite a bit, which kind of helped me from the sense of learning how to adjust to the quote-unquote coming from territorial to independent, because Sandy always had this approach that he would tell us that, you know, you got to go out there and work hard. You got to go out there and work hard every day, kid. You're just no better than nobody else. And I think that works more for me is hearing him say you're no better than nobody else. Referees, I don't know, out here in the Northwest, I guess it's a little more different commodity is what I would say. There's some good refs out here. There's definitely some things that drive me nuts sometimes when it comes to that, but that's just the political part of it. But I think when it came to coming from the territorial, because I got 16 and a half years in this business, and the thing that I learned is I had to be flexible out here because we are so far out here out west that, you know, if I wanted to go do a show in Utah, it was going to take me 13 hours to get there if I drove, or even, you know, a short flight. But the thing was, is if I wanted to go to somewhere like you, I heard you mention Colorado or Wyoming. It's a lot harder here because you're so far up north that to get booked, it's going to take you 16 hours to drive there, or it's going to take you, you know, 200. It's almost not worth to travel, but for me it is, because for me the business has never been about like money. It's never been about that. For me it's been about love. I don't know about the rest of the guests on our panel or people listening to the show right now, but for me what I've always taken was to be flexible and to be not always prepared to quote unquote work out again. That's not a problem. When you go to West Virginia or Florida, I've never gotten to go to the state of Florida to work, so I can't really say. And I haven't really gotten to go to West Virginia, so I'm glad you got those guys on there. But from what I've seen out west here, and, you know, as far as maybe where I've been, it's a little more – got to be a little more flexible out here to work, because the shows are – when I broke in initially, you know, you're 4 or 5 nights a week. Now it's, you know, you get once a week or maybe even once a month out here. And so you really got to know how to adapt from going 4 to 5 days a week to once a week or once a month out here. It's just a little different.
Yeah, to chime in on that, where you were saying about how close everything was for me here in West Virginia, and he was saying that it would take him 13 hours to get to a show. You mentioned Gouge at the beginning of the show here in Raleigh. That's like a 2.5-hour drive from me. PWX was somewhere in North Carolina last night. That was probably 2 or 3 hour drive for me. NWA Smoky Mountain in the Kingsport, Tennessee area, that's a 2 hour drive for me. So everything is within, a lot of shows for me is within a 2 or 3 hour radius. I mean, High Spots, their main company is 3 hours for me. So a lot of those shows, PWX and stuff like that, CWF Mid-Atlantic, are all just within 3 hours of where I live.
Yeah, and from my side, it's a little different. And in the beginning, I remember breaking in, and it used to be how much money did it cost me to go to work, because, you know, the envelope was so small at the start but just to get on the roster. But, you know, there's times like, fortunately, the way the state's split up and just the way wrestling is running in Florida right now, you know, the south end of the state from Miami to West Palm Beach, most of my trips are 60 miles or less. if the next step is there's a big break in the center of the state where nobody's running anything. So now you're either 60 minutes away from a show or you're 3 to 4 hours away from a show. And, you know, in the beginning, a big difference was, you know, I made a living off it, you know, because we worked 7 nights a week plus TV and sometimes a double shot or 2 double shots. So you could work 7 to 9 times a week back in the day, and usually maybe you got 5 days off a year or something like that. It was crazy back in the day. But like now, you know, there's shows I go to, and it's about the love of the business because, I mean, at 61 years old and doing it for 40 years, 41 years, whatever it is, it's all about, you know, just living my dream still because I'm fortunate to get booked. I'm in decent shape and everything. But what I'm saying is because of all the young people out there and all the indie promotions, I'm able to continue living my dream because I have as much fun refereeing now as I did back then. You know, and so a lot of times I try to decide how much is it going to cost me to go to work tonight, you know, because some of the promotions are doing better and there's shows I make money and do okay. There's other shows that, you know, I go in there and it's simply the minute I turn the key on the car, I know it's going to cost me money to go to work. But to the other gentlemen on the line, they know exactly what I'm talking about, you know. You get to live your dream and go out there and have fun, you know.
One of the things I want to ask all of you about is pet peeves. I know everyone that does refereeing has a pet peeve about something, either about the role in particular or about matches that they do specifically. For example, one of my biggest pet peeves is you get a lot of promoters that just do not understand how bad referees can really hurt their shows, and they'll send out anybody they can find that will put on a referee shirt. That just drives me insane. We'll start with Bruce. What's some of your biggest pet peeves as a wrestling referee?
I think the thing, you know, because I've done it a long time, but I learned a long time ago from Eddie Graham, and I mean, Eddie Graham was, when he bought and invested into New York, I'll jump in a little different direction for a quick question, is here's what he did. He bought Florida territory, invested all his money, because Florida was surrounded by water on 3 sides. And in the territory days, that means he could only be invaded by the North. So Florida was one of the strongest territories like that. So the referees, the workers, everybody was very good. But, you know, everyone's got a very important role as a referee. Sometimes you're the mouthpiece communicating back and forth. And, you know, basically your job is to be in the wrong place at the right time all the time. And I think what bothers me the most is, like, when a referee tries to be the star. You know, the referee's job is to be out there and the 2 guys or 4 guys or 6 guys, whatever amounts in the match wrestling, those are the stars, you know. But I'm sure some of the other guys have seen they bring in referees and all they keep doing is looking at the crowd, talking to their friends or, you know, trying to just showboat. And you can't do that, you know. You'll lose your credibility and your position's supposed to be focused on the match and that's it. And if anything, no light shines on you other than if they ever introduce your name, it should be limited to that. So that's just what bothers me.
Eric, how about you? What's your biggest pet peeve in there?
I agree with the showboat thing and what you said earlier about just picking guys out and saying, okay, go ref. I mean, the referee job, the worker's job is extremely hard. It's hard on their bodies and everything else. The referee job, I guess, would perceive as it looks easy, but there's no one really realizes how much actually goes into a wrestling referee, especially the guys, you know, up north. You know, they go through a lot that probably goes through their headsets. Who knows what all goes through their earpieces when they're doing, you know, live TV and stuff like that. But, that bothers me, especially when they just throw a ref shirt to a guy and say, here you go, and they've got jeans on. One other thing that bothers me is that white socks. You know, I'm traditional with the zebra shirt, black pants, black socks, black shoes, solid
great.
Black shoes. You know, that's me. And then a lot of times when referees tape their wrists, I don't know if any of these guys do it. It's fine, but for me, I don't do it. It's kind of like the Brian Hebner thing where he wears the sweatbands. I never really understood why, you know. I mean, he's not going to sell them as gimmicks, so he's not going to make money off of it. I don't know. That's just me. That's personally just me. But that's just a couple of pet peeves of mine.
Now, those are great pointers. And yeah, that's accessorizing a referee is what I call it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, he was talking about some of them showboating. You know, I don't like that either. There's one thing that I do. I slide on the mat for the counts. Especially if I'm out of position. And there's times that I will do one if they're close to the ropes where I actually slide and count. But as I'm counting, I kind of slide out of the ring, but I continue the count, you know, to make sure that everybody not really pays attention to me, but pays attention to know that I am paying attention and counting and watching and everything like that. And but then that's about the extent of anything out of the realm that I do.
T-Rex, how about you? You got a particular pet peeve?
I got a couple of them. Actually, a lot of my pet peeves has to do with, you know, I've watched sometimes referees not check guys, and that's so important in a match. But I think my biggest pet peeve when it comes to reffing anyway with refs is that, you know, a lot of these guys, I don't know which one of you guys mentioned about jeans, but I don't like people wearing jeans in the ring. And I don't like them wearing those, like, weird-looking belts, like camel belts and all that. I mean, that's just my biggest thing. If you're going to be, like, a professional, like, I heard somebody say all black shoes, all black pants. Well, we in the NWA, we have to wear these blue shirts, but no big deal. But I'm traditionalist with black and white, too. I do wear wristbands, so that's just because I have to. But, but so hopefully nobody takes that person. I just have to learn because of my wrists the way they are. But anyway, it's, to me, I guess the biggest thing is it's your appearance in there. And my biggest pet peeve is I see a lot of guys that they don't know when to get in and out of the camera zone, or they don't know when to get in and out of the way of a match because we're literally the third man in that ring. I mean, I recently got the chance to read a little bit of James Beard's book, and I learned how important the third man is in it. So for me, my biggest pet peeve is knowing guys need to stay out of the way of the fans, because that's who's paying us is the fans. And if they can't see because I'm in there checking a hold or I'm in there, you know, that's my bad. That's no one else's fault, but they need to learn that.
Yeah. And with the wristbands thing, that, like I said, that was me personally, but yeah. And when I say jeans, I don't mean like regular jeans, black jeans, you know, get a pair of black dress pants. You know, or something like that. As long as it's not a jean form.
Yeah.
Because I've seen people wear black jeans. And I've even seen, I mean, you had that one ref in ECW a long time ago that would wear the black windbreakers. And, I mean, that even got on my nerves. But, yeah, and speaking of getting out of the way with the fans, of letting them see and making sure you're out of the way, there's a lot of times, and I can't remember who it was I watched, but I've seen somebody do this one time. A guy was climbing the top rope, and when he started the count to tell him to get off the rope, I seen the referee actually, when he was in the opposite corner, he kind of kneeled down to one knee, and I guess it was so the fans could see over him what the worker was doing, but he kept his count. So every now and then, I do that as well.
And I respect the whole gene thing. I respect what a lot of you guys, you gentlemen, are bringing to the table when it comes to that. Because for me, another thing is, don't take this the wrong way, anybody that's listening out here in Beer Land, personal hygiene is big with me. If you can't brush your teeth and wash your ass, you shouldn't be in there.
Yeah, that's actually pretty good. I mean, that goes all the way around. It's pretty bad when you show up at the building at 6:00 and the guy stinks and he hasn't even wrestled or worked out, you know, and Yeah, there's a lot of that in there that you know, it's amazing. And you know, I mean, God, you know, the great thing about being a referee is you're able to stay away, you know. The guy that's working them's got to stay locked in with them for, you know, 10, 15 minutes, you know. So, but I think the great thing is what's been pointed out by a lot of everybody, be professional, go in there. You know, it's like I say, you know, or the guy with blue shoes, green shoes, and, you know, referees, you know, wear what you're supposed to wear, you know, and yeah, go in there, you know, with a professional appearance. Otherwise, you know, and I guess the other thing, it's not referees, but the time, like, you see workers, and some of the guys have gimmicks that it portrays what they wear, but, like, you know, when a guy's been in the business 5 years and he still doesn't have wrestling boots, you know, that kind of pisses me off too. So I just throw that one out there.
Well, at this point, my co-host QT's with us. I'm thinking QT has some questions, so QT, I'll hand things to you for a bit.
Well, thank you, Sangai. Hello, Eric. Hello, Bruce. Hello, T-Rex.
Hey,
hello,
how are you today?
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing pretty good. Eric, you mentioned that you were from West Virginia. How is the collegiate wrestling scene in West Virginia, keeping in mind that Iowa, Iowa State, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, and sometimes Notre Dame and Lehigh have the collegiate wrestling scene pretty much locked up?
I don't really know. I don't follow it a whole lot. I'm in southern West Virginia. You know, if anybody knows the state, I'm right on the Virginia line, so a lot of that, you know, WVU and stuff is kind of like 5 hours away from me. So I really don't follow it a whole lot. Now, we have some high school wrestling here in the area. My high school I actually went to didn't actually have a wrestling team, which kind of upset me. When I was there, they got it much, much later. But they seem to do fairly well. They have actually both guys and girls on the teams for both area schools here in town. So, you know, as far as the college level goes and collegiate wrestling, I really don't follow it a whole lot. So I'm probably not a good one to answer that one.
Oh, okay. Now, you said that your high school didn't have a wrestling team. Did you participate in any AAU teams or city-wide league wrestling teams? Did your city have a kind of a youth,
no, actually, our city didn't have a wrestling. No one in this area had a wrestling league except the high school in Virginia, and I wasn't there. It was just recently, and I mean recently as in maybe 2-3 years ago, that the city actually started doing some, like, city wrestling, which is coached by the two coaches from our two local high schools here, because, like I said, we're right on the border. And then I think my high school actually got a wrestling team maybe, I want to say, no more than 10 years ago. Maybe less than that. And, you know, they've done okay. They haven't won many awards. Actually, I think the Virginia side, actually, one of their guys just won a championship tournament yesterday. I'm not sure what it was, but yeah. So it there was really no amateurish wrestling around in this area.
Oh, okay. All right. Bruce, I'm going to ask you the same question. Did you turn out for wrestling in high school?
No, you got to understand, man, I was like a stick man. I was like, when I got out of high school, I was 131 pounds soaking wet and 6'2". So, you know, I would have got my ass kicked in plain words. So, you know, I kind of stayed away from it, you know. I mean, other than being a kid where all of us pretend we were this wrestler, that wrestler, you know, and doing our stuff in the yards and stuff back then. But no, I didn't get involved into anything. I did cross country, and that was about it because it was good. I you know, had long legs I could do pretty good at, and nobody could kick my butt, you know, physically. So I went that route for a while. But other than that's pretty much what it was.
Oh, all right. Okay. Bruce, here's a little bit of trivia. Did you know that Ken Kesey, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and one of the original merry pranksters that made his way across the nation in a psychedelic bus called Further, was once a wrestler at the University of Oregon and a very good wrestler at that, Ken Kesley.
Wow, that's hard to believe, but since you're saying it, I believe you. That's very interesting, though. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was definitely a tremendous movie. You know, it's a hard one to top, you know. And I think if you looked at One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and you go to a wrestling locker room, you know, there's a little bit of everybody in that crowd, you know.
Even the Indian chief that ripped
yeah,
up
Yeah, well, in Florida, suit. You know, we got a lot of reservations and wrestling at the reservations, so there's always we don't have to get the gimmick Indians. We got a lot of real ones down here that we can pull from, you know.
Oh, now, Bruce, speaking of that, did you ever have a chance to meet Chief Wahoo McDaniel?
Actually, one of my most memorable matches, and actually I was with Ric Flair about 2 weeks ago. He was doing a Comic-Con, and I went to see him, and we were talking about it was Wahoo McDaniels and Ric Flair in a steel chair, and the building's called the War Memorial Auditorium. It's a veteran building type of thing, and it was a steel cage match. And I had, not to showcase this too much, but real quick, I'd taken a bump when Flair dropped down and Wahoo hit me, and I actually for real hit my head on the steel post of where the gate was, the part of the gate for the cage entrance, and it split my head a little. And when I went down and for the count, I went to count the 1, 2, 3. Well, blood was coming out, looked like it was coming out of my ear, and Flair actually laid down for a 3 count. And I counted a 1, 2, 3 on Ric Flair in the center of the ring. We had a house announcer who wasn't part of the show, rang the bell, announced, you know, Wahoo, the new world champion. And, of course, you know, I have to just pull his hand down, argue with him. And Nate went ahead and rolled him up real quick for a 1, 2, 3 with the tights. And we had a hard time getting out that night of the cage because it was so bad. People had basically saw themselves get screwed out of the world championship. And so there was an article in the paper the next day, War Breaks Loose at the War Memorial, and they showed all the damage and everything. And, you know, it was cool because it was the kayfabe days and the people really believed it and were hot. And we were just talking about that. Wahoo was one of the guys that gave me my big push. I was before I was a ring announcer and TV announcer, and then got into being a referee. But Wahoo was one of the ones that gave me some of my greatest runs as a referee, and when he was booking here in Florida and stuff, and was real tight with him and rode with him probably 3 to 4 nights a week. So simply one of the, you know, matches like him and the Sheik, him and Bruiser Brody, him and Abdullah the Butcher, him and, you know, just tremendous matches. I mean, because he'd be laying it in there, you know. I mean, that's what sold, you know, tickets in those days. But the Chief is definitely one of the real deals of professional wrestling. And, you know, I think anything else that followed him was secondary, you know.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, you said that you traveled down the road with Chief Wahoo McDaniels.
Yep.
To other events?
Well, Florida back then, you know, Florida was basically like Monday was West Palm, which I lived in Miami, but Monday was like a 60-70 mile trip. Tuesday was Tampa. Wednesday we had TV in Miami. Thursday, Jacksonville. Friday, Gainesville or Fort Lauderdale. Saturday was Lakeland, or Saturday, Sunday were the Bahamas and stuff. So back then, a lot of times we traveled by car because it was just too hard to go commercial, expensive. Flights weren't leaving. You know, when wrestling got over in those days, because the matches were long, you couldn't be at the airport till maybe 11, 11:30. And back then, the flights weren't running, you know, like to a city like Tampa, the headquarters were based out of and stuff. The flights just weren't running that late. So I'd say, if anything, we only flew once a week, or like if it was Bahamas, obviously we flew over there. But, you know, the ability to fly too much was limited. Then we started doing charters and stuff, and you know, those were days and time when actually I dropped off the guys at Opa-locka Airport the night that the plane went down with Buddy Holt was flying, and Bobby Shane died, and Mike McCord, Austin Idol, and the guys. I actually had dropped those guys off that night at the airport, only to wake up the next day to find out the plane went down. You know, so pretty crazy,
oh,
but a lot
very
of good
tragic.
Times. I mean, that's why the road trips were crazy, and you know, all the stories that you hear of what these guys would do on the road, a lot of them are true. You know, so.
Now, did you ever have a wrestler that instead of he tried to talk you out of paying his share of the gas money, and instead he offered to pay you in coffee?
You know, how do you say it? I think wrestling in all aspects, and probably some of the guys can agree, is brings out the best and the worst in people, you know. And there's guys in the business that are loyal to the business, the workers, and just good people. And then there's a lot of guys that, you know, whether it's their regular jobs or whatever they got, they're so cheap on the road, it's pathetic and stuff, you know. I won't name the name of the guy because he's still kind of active, and I'll just put it one time. At one time, and there's one of the NWA guys here, but he was president of NWA at one time, and he didn't want to pay the gas. And well, he was getting 10% of all of our bookings. Then when we got to a restaurant, he wanted me to pick up his bill. So I told the guys to go in the car. And when he was in the crapper, I went ahead and I pulled out and left him probably 3 hours from 12 noon TV the next day. It was about 2 hours from TV, which was Universal Studios for Herb Abrams. But I left him just because he was cheap. And he had to call somebody from Miami to pick him up 2 hours away, then drive him another 3 hours to Orlando, you know. So since then, we've buried the heat. That's the good thing about being old, you know. I got 40 years, so, you know, something that goes on, you know, 5 years later, something usually goes away. But, you know, I told him why I did it, you know. I said, and that's the way it is in the business. Everybody kicks in and takes care of each other. When you don't, you know, sometimes I make a decision, you know, but that's probably the worst thing I did. But the weather was good, so it wasn't like, and I did leave him at a Denny's, so, you know, it wasn't like I left him on the side of the road. Now, I've seen guys taking a piss on the side of the road and guys take off and leave him there, you know, and they know the next group of guys coming by will pick him up, you know, a half hour behind him or something. That's a little awkward, but I've always left people in buildings when I've left them.
Oh, okay, well, that's good, okay. Well, Bruce, you said that you are stationed in the Florida area. Did you ever referee a match in Key West?
Yes. We Championship Wrestling from Florida. Believe it or not, my first crack at being an announcer was there, because back then that's when we were doing double shots. So I was actually an announcer, and I got to work with Gordon Soley back then. So Key West, I was there for every show that we did, and I never forget, you talk about guys driving and everything. I remember Frankie Lancaster, or Frankie the Thumper Lane, Frankie Lancaster, he had a couple different names. I never forget, he drove from Tampa to Key West, which is about 8 hours, okay, wrestled, went out with us, and we weren't eating dinner, we were partying, and then drove back to Tampa the same night. And it wasn't because he was cheap, he at the time he had a baby on the way and stuff like that, so he wanted to get back. But I was like, man, here's a guy that can drive. So after that, everybody knew if it was a long trip, ride with Frankie, he won't fall asleep, you know.
Wow. Did you happen to catch a drink at Sloppy Joe's that night?
Sloppy Joe's, the greatest thing about Sloppy Joe's, and yet again, this was the kayfabe days, and so you got the heels on one side of the street across from Sloppy Joe's, and the baby face is on another. Now, the crowd, some of the crowd is with the heels, some of the crowd is with the babies. Now they're drunk, okay, meaning everybody. So the next thing you know, the wrestlers are now conning the fans to go kick the other fans' butts. So the next thing breaks out is this big fight between the fans. Of course, all the wrestlers, they got cut into the hotel rooms, into the bars and everything, and get away, and probably about 30 people got arrested that night, and probably about 100 should have. But, I mean, just this big fight breaks loose. And, you know, Key West is very small. They don't have very many police. But, you know, all these drunk people that, they just wanted to be with the wrestlers. And, you know, a wrestler telling them, yeah, you can kick that guy, or just pick the little one, you know. And so, yeah, it was pretty good.
Wow.
I'm impressed. Okay, that's... I knew about us running Key West, you know. That impresses me.
What I was stationed in Key West twice with the Coast Guard. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I know where I think that would be the whistle across the street from Sloppy Joe's.
Yeah, you're right.
Oh, okay. Well, Eric, what's the strangest foreign object you have seen a wrestler pull from his trunks?
Dildo.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
Straight answer there. it was just a rib from the back. There's a town here called Oak Hill, West Virginia. We were doing weekly shows. I mean, every Tuesday night we were drawing, you know, at this time it was 1999, 2000. We were drawing about 150, 200 people every week. On a Tuesday night, 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night. And it was just a rib one night. And the guy did it, and I was just like, okay. So, yeah, that's probably the weirdest thing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Eric and Bruce play a game on Turnbuckle Turmoil called Bring on the Choice, Bring on the Funk. And you can picture yourself like on a psychiatrist's couch, and the psychiatrist offers you a picture, and you have to say the first thing that pops into your mind, or you have to make a choice between two pictures very instantaneously. Like if you hold up a picture of a car and airplane, you got to choose. Are you ready to play this game?
Yes, I'm ready. Let's go for the two pictures.
Sure.
Okay, Bruce, I'm going to start out with you. Frog Splash or Frankensteiner?
Frankensteiner.
Gibson Leg Lock or Gibson Guitar?
Guitar.
Okay. Brock Lesnar or Triple H?
The Game.
Okay. Sasha Banks or Brie Bella?
I'll go with the Bellas. I'm a twin, so that's where I'm going with.
Oh, okay. I'm going to mark that down, Brie Bella. Okay, very good. AJ Styles or Chris Jericho?
Jericho.
Hip roll or hip toss?
Hip toss.
Indian deathlock or inverted atomic drop?
Go with the deathlock.
Strap match or cage match?
Cage match.
Midget wrestling or lady wrestling?
Never trust a midget. I'll go with the midget. They only play miniature golf.
Oh! Okay. Very good. I'm going to triple underline midget there. Very good. All right. Plane ride or car trip?
Road trip. Car trip.
Okay. Eric, I'm going to start with you here. Wrestling okay. Singlet or trunks?
Trunks.
Scientific match or bloody brawl?
Scientific.
Okay. Terry Gordy or Terry Funk?
Terry Funk.
Hunting or fishing?
Fishing.
Wahoo McDaniel or Chief J Strongbow?
Strongbow.
Okay. Energy drink or coffee?
Energy drink.
Four Horsemen or New World Order?
Horsemen.
Greco-Roman arm lock or hangman's neck breaker?
Neck breaker.
Neck breaker, okay. Heart punch or vertical suplex?
Heart punch.
Top rope rocker dropper or top rope suplex?
Rocker dropper.
Okay. Tornado DDT or tornado punch?
DDT.
Front suplex or front face lock?
suplex.
Okay. Gorilla press or gut wrench?
Gorilla press.
Okay. Indian death lock or inverted atomic drop?
I'll go with the death lock.
All right. Vader bomb or vertical suplex?
Suplex.
Okay. Japanese arm drag or tree of woe?
Japanese arm drag. No
question. Oh, okay. Mask or face paint?
A hood mask.
Okay. T-Rex, Battle Royal, or Iron Man match?
Iron Man match.
Kiss or REO Speedwagon?
Kiss.
Paul Stanley, the Star Child, or Gene Simmons, the Demon?
Oh, shit. Gene Simmons.
Okay. Jackhammer or Japanese arm drag?
Jackhammer.
Vlad the Impaler or Genghis Khan?
Genghis Khan.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, now, T-Rex, can you guess the wrestler that said, I'm trying to find a place with peace, and if not, then let's fill it with mayhem? Who said this?
Was that Lonnie Mane?
No, close. It was Roddy Piper.
Oh, geez, I should have known that one. Wow.
Well, okay. Oh, and I got one more. Bring on the choice. Bring on the funk, T-Rex. How about Seabass or Brook Trout Almondine?
What? Who?
Come on. Seabass or Brook Trout Almondine?
Yeah, I'm going to go neither.
Okay. Okay, very good. All right. Well, T-Rex, did you know that Roddy Piper and Jesse Ventura were once slated to do a series using the writers from Magnum PI? They even shot the pilot. The show was to be known as Tag Team. Who in blue collar wrestling would you like to do a show called Tag Team that parodies this show that Roddy Piper and Jesse Ventura shot the pilot of? Would it be Roy Lovejoy and Gregor Petrov?
That's an interesting pair right there. I'd love to see that just from the standpoint of if the men like each other, but hey. Okay, why not? Sure.
All right, okay, I'm going to put that down. Okay, very good. Well, Bruce and Eric, it was good talking with you. T-Rex, a pleasure as always. And I'm going to turn it back over to Sign Guy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, QT. Well, gentlemen, we have just a few minutes left, so I want to make sure all of you have time to say anything in closing you'd like, plug and promote anything, upcoming shows, social medias, merchandise, anything at all that you guys would like. We'll start with Bruce, who has the most years in the business.
Yeah, well, first of all, I hope all you other guys get as much time in the business as I do and continue to dreams. But one, it's been an honor to be on the show. Two, it's been an honor to listen to the other two referees and their viewpoints. And, you know, I'm glad you guys are carrying on the tradition. That means a lot to me.
Eric, I believe you're next in the years in business. We'll go with you.
Oh, sure. It's been an honor to talk to everybody else. We definitely need to do this again because I think this is just scratching the surface on a lot of things. But, you can watch me ref on YouTube, WVCW, West Virginia Championship Wrestling. WVCW-TV is our call handle. I also help run this promotion. You can find us on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Snapchat, all that, WVCW-TV. Our next event is March 5th, Princeton, West Virginia. We're having a 40-man, kind of like Royal Rumble style, to see who will face our champion next. We have Ring of Honor's Adam Page going to be there, John Skyler, who's done some stuff for NXT, former NWA World Tag Team Champions, the Heatseekers. We've also got, fresh off his Ring of Honor stuff that I think aired maybe 2 weeks ago, Jason the Gift Kincaid. He's a regular with us. Everybody's been talking about and raving about his match with Leo Rush that he just had on the Top Prospects tournament. You can actually watch our TV from last week that actually we were the first ones to do that match 2 weeks prior to the Ring of Honor one. So, yeah, anybody that listens to this, if you're in the Princeton, West Virginia area, Saturday night, March 5th, come on out. Have a good time.
T-Rex.
First of all, you can come to our show tonight, NWA Blue Collar Wrestling at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter in Portland, Oregon, and see me and all of our other stars that we have at the, on the show tonight. I want to plug our, I guess we just now recently started TV out here, our show. I think you can catch it on channels 11 and 21 on Comcast. I also just want to plug that, you know, children's hospitals, because I'm big on the children's hospital thing, seeming how that's how I got my start and everything with business and life. So I just want to plug children's hospitals all over the country. Thank you for what you guys have done for me and several other people. I'd like to personally thank Sign Guy and these other referees because I've learned a lot from you gentlemen today that I can take on for the rest of my career, however long that may be. And again, I just want to thank all the viewers that may be out there watching, and especially QT for some of the random questions that were out there. That was fun. Anyway, I'm gonna leave it at that. Oh, and my merchandise stuff. You can see my wife tonight. If you're fans of Blue Collar Wrestling, you can come see my wife and the gentlemen and ladies that sell the merchandise over there. I now have shirts and hats as well. So I look forward to seeing you guys tonight. And pretty fine gentlemen and panel. Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure having all of you on today. I appreciate you taking the time today to be with us. We'll definitely have to do this again with everybody. Like Eric said, I think we just barely scratched the surface on this. So we'll be back with everybody, I'm sure, a future time. Fans, you can check me out at NWA Blue Collar. I'll be there with T-Rex tonight. And tune in. Next week, we have Cruiserweight Day, all cruiserweights, including the aforementioned Jason the Gift Kincaid. So join us next week. Should be an outstanding show. And get out there, support your local independent pro wrestling wherever it may be near you.